Welcome to the Standard Deviations Podcast, presented by Orion Advisor Solutions and hosted by Dr. Daniel Crosby, Orion's Chief Behavioral Officer and New York Times best-selling author. Each week, Dr. Crosby interviews a fascinating new guest on a range of compelling topics, from literature to psychology to financial wellness. To learn more about Dr. Crosby's behavioral finance work at Orion, visit www.orion.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Standard Deviations Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Daniel Crosby, and I am joined today by Hoda Mehr. She is the CEO and founder of StockCard, and she's here today to talk to us about the intersection of decision-making, behavioral finance, and fintech. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Daniel. So excited to be on your podcast.
Yes. Well, we have had some awesome conversations. I have learned so much from you, and I'm excited for the listeners to be able to do the same. But first of all, just give us some quick background on you and how you became the head of a fintech.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's sort of surreal, I have to say, because the first time I got to know you, I got to hear your voice through a podcast. It wasn't your podcast, it was another podcast you were a guest at. And then, you know, the story, I kind of got to read your book, and then now I'm on your podcast. So it's sort of like full 360 cycle of podcasts kind of coming together. Exactly. So that's really cool. Yeah. So as you said, Hoda, my name is Hoda, co-founder and CEO of StockCard. And StockCard is an early stage fintech startup out of Silicon Valley. And our mission is to prevent and predict cognitive biases or behavioral mistakes, specifically for do-it-yourself investors. And, you know, how I came about is, it's interesting because I never thought I'm going to start a company focused on investing, because I always thought investing is going to be something I'm going to do on the side. And that would fund other things I'm going to do in my life, or like start other companies. I always knew I wanted to start a company. I just never thought it's going to be a fintech or focused on investing. Because I learned to invest from my dad when I was a teenager. And for me, it was like, everybody invests. That's part of everyone's life. So there's no need to create a company around it. You would do that to do other things in your life. With that kind of mindset, I went about like doing a lot of other things. Like when I was a teenager, I wanted to have an ice cream shop. I always wanted to have a business. So it started as the ice cream shop. And then like it evolved into, you know, when I went to college, a boyfriend at the time, husband now, we wanted to start a virtual online video game league because he's into video games. And then I kind of wanted to start a company and said, why not combine this together? And then we wanted to start a wine bar and restaurant. So anyways, like, and you name it, any business in the world that you could probably start, we had it on our list at some point and started like putting plans together. And all the way to, you know, just investing was kind of going with itself on the sideline of my life. And then at some point I realized, wait a minute, there is a big problem in the world of investing, and why not? And I'm very passionate about it. And that's something that it's always been part of my life. Why not do that? And that's how really the seed of StockCard came about.
So when was that moment? You know, I think all the best businesses are built on sort of this realization of a problem that you're well positioned to solve. When did it become apparent to you that behavioral bias, that misbehavior, was sort of the nut of the problem with investing? When was that realization? Because I don't think everyone understands that at first.
Yeah, no, I think it came from reflection on my own behavior. As every investor, you know, you could be an investor and kind of you could just like have fun or not have fun. You just kind of invest. But the best kind of investors, I think they go and reflect back on their own decisions. And then early on in my investing career of like life, I learned to write a diary on my decision making process. So I had these Google Sheets, Excel files, and then it became Google Sheets that I would write down three reasons I invest in something. And then I would go back to them every now and then and read them. And then gradually I realized that, oh, a lot of times I made a lot of decisions ignoring my initial hypothesis or thesis, let's say, like the reasons I wrote. Or I really love stories. So power of stories has a big influence on me. Like I love a good story about a company, right? Especially when it comes about a company or like a good story about a CEO. I always like make fun of myself. I have like CEO crushes. Like for many years, I had like this big CEO crush on Howard Schultz, CEO, founder of, not founder, but CEO of, ex-CEO of Starbucks. So like, I would go back to my reasoning. I'm like, oh, I fell for the story of, because I really love the CEO as a CEO and I really want to be him at some point in my life. And then like, okay, so the stock has to be really good because I like the CEO. So for me, it's just, it came from reading my own investor diary and realizing even me that I think I'm a really good investor, I fall for these things. And then gradually I started reading books about the topic. And one thing to another, that was really like in 2016, end of 2016, early 2017. It's when the moment, the aha moment came that I realized there is a connection. And if I have the problem, everybody else has. And then at the time, I had a Facebook community, like a private Facebook community that I started, and people would talk about investing, and I started seeing the world from the lens of behavioral finance or behavioral mistakes. And then I just kind of like, it was really like, I would see the reflection of behavioral mistakes and cognitive biases in everything. And I'm like, oh my God, we can solve this. Oh my God, we can solve that. And that was the aha moment. Bring this together.
Yeah. So a realization of your own imperfections, your ability to fall prey to narrative bias, your tendency to fall in love with a story, your tendency to invest for one ostensible reason, but then to deviate from that. I wish I could say you were alone in that. I've certainly fallen prey to all those things. I'm sorry you won't get to vote for Howard Schultz for president this year.
I know. Yes.
You were excited for a minute there.
I know.
Yeah. So in this crazy year of 2020, this has been dubbed by some as the year of the Robin Hood trader. And we could debate the impact or lack of impact of Robin Hood traders. But what is undeniable is that they have been on the tip of everyone's tongue and at the top of mind. And part of the conversation has become around how Robin Hood itself as a platform, some have suggested that it's actually designed to facilitate overtrading, to facilitate churning and bad behavior. Mm-hmm. So we're going to talk in a minute about your product, which you have designed to help people make the best decisions possible. Mm-hmm. But I want you to put on your black hat right now and to think as evil as possible. If you were going to use your powers for evil and design an evil fintech, what would it look like to bring about the worst behavior possible?
Yeah. So I think I'm going to say something because I love Robin Hood. Before I answer a question, I think what you said as Robin Hood creating, resulting into some of the bad behaviors that we see from investors, from do-it-yourself investors, is not intentional on their behalf. I think what they've done is fantastic from a point of view of creating great product. And then they started learning from intuitive products from other sectors and other industries, and they brought it into the world of finance and investing. And that's where probably they're going wrong, because not necessarily every other framework for intuitive and better product development would apply in the context of investing. Similar to like, not every other ways that you create a product in other categories, let's say for e-commerce, would apply to like health and wellness and fitness kind of things. The investing needs that stop in terms of product development, and then kind of help companies build a better product. So I wanted to preface that, because I think it's not that they're evil, but like it just happened because they ignored some aspect of developing a good investment product development. And we can talk about that, because we've investigated that obviously a lot, because a lot of our users also are Robinhood users or other similar platform users. So, but if I want to wear my evil hat and be a little bit of an evil genius here, I guess to make a lot of money, is exactly what we just talked about. Not to ignore behavioral aspect, but really double down on behavioral aspect. So for example, yesterday, as a matter of fact, we were reviewing a product feature on our platform. And then we were talking about how do we surface some information to our users? And then we started getting into confirmation, into this discussion of, is it better for people to keep following and getting notifications about a stock or a company? When do we stop? When is too many, right? Is it okay? Because as a platform, we have the power of keep encouraging and incentivizing and design the platform in a way that people keep following and following and following. And at some point you could be following thousands of companies and you could get notifications and notifications and get like almost constant this stimulus, like mental stimulus of, oh my God, what's happening here? Oh my God, this company is undervalued. Oh, that company has been down 2%. So you could actually manipulate the way you create your features to create a highly, highly engaging product that is fun and is stimulus to your brain, a constant send you a stimulus to your brain, and then support that with the power of like gain and loss, like the emotions of gaining and loss, losing. And then that can be a very addictive product, more than even how Facebook or like some of the social medias are addictive. And I think you could easily do that. If you understand the power of behavior and you understand how you could stimulate people with these kind of behavioral, aspects to their usage, and then, you know, apply some of like personalization things to it, you could addict people to a product that is definitely not good for them.
So let me ask you a related question. Netflix has this documentary out right now, The Social Dilemma, talking about sort of the addictive nature of Instagram, Facebook, other such social media platforms. And what I think that Instagram and Facebook and others have done is they've designed a product that for creating shareholder value is undeniably powerful. I mean, it does, I guess, what it's intended to do. But research has also shown that it makes people depressed. You know, I mean, it's been used to spread misinformation about elections. Like it has all these sort of negative ancillary effects. As technologists, what responsibility do we have to maximize shareholder value versus maximize stakeholder value for the larger populace? How do you think about that when designing your product?
Yeah, it is a fantastic question, because it's very difficult to create, let's say, rules and regulations around these things, as we've seen how, you know, a lot of regulators are trying to do that. So it's very difficult to enforce these rules. So it has to start with embedding these things in your company's value from day one. And I bring an example from our own company, sort of. I wrote a day zero letter to the employees at the time, and hopefully employees, many, many more employees in the future of the company. And I wrote down that nothing in our bottom line, our personal bottom line or company's bottom line or our investors or board members or whoever should prevent us from going away from the mission of making better investment decisions or enabling users make better investment decisions. And then when we develop product features, we have this checklist and validate our product development against that checklist and ask, is this feature going to make people better investor? And that's really that mental pause or product development pause we give to ourselves to ask ourselves whether we are true to our mission. So that's sort of because we are always in this space. We wanted to have the behavioral aspect to our platform, so we have a very deep understanding of it. But the only other way I would see that a company is going to do is that it's going to start like respecting this behavioral aspect of their product is just what's happening with ESGs, right? At some point, the environmental aspect or diversity, those things were not part of definition of what success means for a company. And then there's just societal revolution or evolution, I guess, gradually is happening that companies wake up to it and companies see the influence and the result of respecting this new framework of thinking about product development. And then it gradually becomes part of the DNA of companies. But I think at the beginning, it starts from the founder, the CEO, the product team, be mindful of this is an important aspect of their life, that just the same as carbon footprint is important, or just the same as diversity in your board matters. And so it's that framework of mindset that should gradually change.
Yeah. So I posted now what has become one of my most popular tweets of all time, embarrassingly. Yesterday I posted a picture of a Baskin Robbins milkshake, and I said, America's back, baby. And it had, it's this new milkshake at Baskin Robbins, has 2,600 calories, has 330 grams of carbohydrate, has nearly 300 grams of sugar, 3 days worth of saturated fat. I mean, it's absolutely insane. And it also looks really good.
It is.
But it's like, should, yeah. you know, and so it prompted this discussion in the conversation, in the comments section of should companies be able to sell what is effectively something that's just horrible for you. But this mm-hmm. is a larger conversation, but I don't know that we want to, and we certainly can't expect to have, you know, the powers that be legislate away everything mm-hmm. that's bad for us. So I think it's a call for us to know ourselves, to do business with mission-driven companies like your own who put, mm-hmm. Responsible factors first. So let's talk mm-hmm. about your company now. You can take your black hat off now, put your white hat back on, because you have mm-hmm. developed a fintech to help people make better decisions. How can technology be used to help us overcome our worst behavioral impulses?
Yeah, so it's interesting because technology, as we talk about, can help you make very bad decisions. But at the same time, if you try to apply that, if you try to understand the process of people make investment decisions or any decisions for that matter, and dissect that, it's into components. There are aspects of that decision making process that technology can enable and really influence if the framework is there, right? So what we've done at StockCard, we said we looked at how people make investment decisions, how do-it-yourself investors make investment decisions, and we tried to figure out where the gap exists. If you think about an investment decision, it starts from some sort of a trigger that grabs people's attention. It could be internally driven, like they need to be better at their finances, or they hear something in the news, or a company goes IPO, something like that. So those triggers, there's so much technology and innovation has happened in news and sentiment and things like that. Then the next step of that is people need information, right? So they need that information, and then there's so much tech innovation has happened about information gathering. So from very basic things like, or very, very long lasting things such as Yahoo Finance or Google Finance that have been out there, to many, many ways of gathering and collecting and aggregating information. Then you need to get that information and translate it into some insights or some action. And let's park that for a second. We're going to come back to it. And then the last piece of your decision is, or like your decision-making process is like actually executing the decision, right? Which is where Robinhood sits, or so much automation has happened. So these four pieces of decision of a decision-making of into an investment decision, there is a piece of it, which is translation of information and triggers and everything like that to a final decision that has happened, that the least amount of innovation has happened. It's traditionally the space of education, right? There's so many websites that help people educate and understand and how to make investment decision or how to manage the finances. But there hasn't been much of focus in enable using the deep technology in that space of translation of triggers and information to an actionable insights. And that's where we fit. That's where we came in and we said, okay, how do people translate information to insights, and how can we use a combination of deep technology such as AI and machine learning with a framework of behavioral decision-making or behavioral finance, and then drastically change that translation of information to insights. So I guess a sort of like a nerdy way of answering to your questions, but yeah, we basically dug deep into that decision-making process and found a place that there is least amount of innovation has happened. And we think that's where the most of the troubles are being created. And we're focusing on that.
So I love that positioning, right? There's a lot of educational resources out there. There's certainly probably even more like execution type resources there. But this psychological space between, how do you take this impetus or this trigger and turn it into a good decision, is sort of this gray, this limbo where there hasn't been much innovation, and that's where you fit. Can you be as practical as possible and talk about sort of concretely, how do you make that happen? You know, how do you take those insights, many of which, by the way, are bad, right? Like many times that spark, that initial interest would be based on some sort of spurious reasoning or, you know, some melodramatic news article. How do you intervene practically in that space between in a way that benefits investors?
Yeah. Yeah. So if to understand what we do, I think we can go back to some of the work that companies like autonomous car technologies are doing right now. So basically, autonomous car technology looks at how a driver makes the make a driving decision, right? Looks at, okay, I look at the light and I look at the environment and I look at whether there's a passenger by, is there's a cat moving, right? And then they use the AI technology to, they use LIDARs or scanners to scan the environment, and then they use AI technology to digest that information and then predict what's going to happen, and then they force the car to, or they direct or command the car to take a specific action. So we do exactly the same thing. Our technology is exactly behave the same way. We scan the environment and then we use the AI technology to see what was historically the response of that specific investor to that trigger. So now let's just talk about in the world of investing. We look at when the market went down, a very, very basic example. When the market went down 5%, what did Hoda do in the last 10 times that the market had a similar movement? And then we use that as an indicator of what is Hoda gonna do the next time. And then we look at the behavior that the investor is showing at that point, like what kind of investor behavior the investor is showing at that point. And then what we do is we predict whether this is going to be a good decision or a bad decision. And so it's a constant loop of scanning the environment and looking at what the user has the most likelihood to do in response to that changes in the trigger on that environmental changes or that trigger, and then helping that user to prevent what was used to be a bad decision.
So if I'm understanding this correctly, you're looking at sort of the macro investing environment and then comparing that to the micro internal decision-making environment and combining those things to give recommendations. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. So it's a correlation between what happens in the external environment. Let's say market goes up and down, sentiment goes up and down, news goes up and down, and what the user used to do historically in response to that changes, and then figure out which combination of these behaviors and these triggers historically has resulted into bad decision, and historically which ones historically resulted in good decision. And then it's basically very fascinating because the market triggers can be very unique, right? It could market can go, there's like millions of different variations of market triggers or triggers in general, like sentiment triggers. But the responses that people show these things are not too many, right? People either panic or not panic. People either like log into their accounts or ignore it. People either sell or not sell. So there's only infinite, there's only a small predictable of ways that people respond to variety of triggers. And that's really the golden nugget is, because the market cannot be predictable, but people's reaction to market is very predictable and it's very repetitive. And that's really cool, because if you can find something that repeats itself several millions of times, you can then predict that and then you can prevent that. And that's really, that's really where our technology basically comes in.
One that is fascinating, I think one of the things that I find hardest about studying investment decision making is the role of luck. Like you can get the right result for the wrong reason. You can make an entirely stupid decision based on the inputs and based on the probabilities and still hit it big. So how do you account for this role of luck and the possibility of people making what is in fact a good decision and getting a bad result, or a bad decision and getting a good result? How do you disentangle those things?
Yeah, it's a very good point, because it's basically similar to, again, like if you go back to driving a car, right, you could make a bad decision, but like you don't hit the car because you just get lucky. And then the car also can make a bad decision and doesn't hit. So it's never 100% foolproof, but rarely someone gets lucky 20, 25, 30 times in a row. It's very rare that you come across an investor that always did bad things, a bad decision patterns, or responded to FOMO or followed the herd or was overconfident about what they were doing, and then always resulted into a good result, right? So that's why when you're building a technology like ours, you need cycles of decision making to train your AI model, your AI engine, or your machine learning engine in order to get the highest success rate. So the more your user use the platform, and the more we collect information about people's investment decision behavior and patterns and their historical transactions, the better and more accurate the AI goes. It's all in power of repetition. And obviously if you have only one data point, it's very difficult to make any sort of decision, any sort of prediction on it. But if you have 10, 20, 100 days that you look at people's behavior in response to market triggers, and the beauty of the stock market is that these triggers happen constantly. We constantly see people's responses to triggers, and we constantly can trade AI model. It's just the power of accumulation of that investment research pattern that you can rule out what are just luck and what are the actual responses.
There you go, powerful stuff.
Yeah.
So one of the things that we know is that what composes the universe of investors has changed quite a bit over the last 50 years. Mm-hmm. The number, the size and number of retail investors has been shrinking, even as the tools that empower retail investors have gotten bigger, better, faster, stronger. So we know now that just from a dollar weighted perspective, about 3/4 of the money that's moving around the market on any day is professional money managers, institutional mm-hmm. money managers. We also know that from research out of Taiwan and other research that most active do-it-yourself day trader types, you know, blow themselves up. Mm-hmm. Very few of them show skill. So why intervene with so many pros against you? What hope does the active DIY investor have? And why did you choose to try and help that segment of the population?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of answers to it. There's one is I'm not in that segment, right? I am a firm believer as a CEO of a company, or like as a person who wanted to start a company, I would only be able to solve the problem that I have myself, right? I have experienced it. So that's just because I'm not in that segment. The second part of it is, when you look at the data of the trend of do-it-yourself investing, it has gone up and down, but it has never eliminated, right? We still, as of the last in figures that we found or we looked, there is 30% of the adults in the United States are recognize themselves or associate themselves for being either fully or partially do-it-yourself investor. So we can keep saying to people that do-it-yourself investing should not happen, or we can keep giving the advice of saying that don't go and actively manage your money or like make investment decisions, just the same as we can keep telling people don't eat that milkshake that you were just talking about, but that milkshake comes out and people still order it. Like, we should look at the sales volume of that milkshake once actually it's out, and then you'll realize a lot of people know they shouldn't eat it, but anyways, you're going to eat it. So to us, we went after this segment is that because we believe there is a segment of population that still do that. And then there's hundreds of years of history of data that despite everything that has happened, despite all the good advice that is out there, there is still people that would do it. And so there's no point of keep telling people don't do it because that's not going to do them any good, right? Like, they're going to anyways do it. And we see it. As soon as you removed a barrier such as a small fee in terms of transaction fee by Robinhood and this whole no fee, low fee revolution that has happened, what a big surge we've seen in desire to manage their money, or at least make self-directed investors. So to me, it's just an innate being in charge of your own money and making your own investment decisions, an innate desire that exists. And all the world can tell you not to do it, but people still do it. That segment's never going to go away from our point of view. So we said, okay, why not now accept that as the rule of the game, and then see what can we do within this boundary of people always want to make that that active decision, at least partially.
So if that group's going to exist, we might as well serve them well. They might as well have access to institutional quality type information and some behavioral guardrails. You know, I think it's worth mentioning too that it's not binary. You know, like someone like me, I have the majority of my money with a wealth manager, with a financial advisor, but I do still keep a small account. And that's actually something from a behavioral perspective that I encourage a lot of people to do, to keep 3 to 5% of their money in a do-it-yourself account, because someone like me has an urge to sort of, you know, DIY trade or day trade an account, but I don't want to do that with the bulk of my wealth. But, you know, keeping that 3 to 5% is effectively like a cheat day for me, right? You know, we'll keep using milkshake analogies. You know, it keeps me, interested and engaged with the market, but not in a way that's going to blow me up in a meaningful way. So it helps me scratch that itch without doing anything detrimental with the bulk of my savings.
Yeah. I think you mentioned something interesting. I always go back to this, the revolution of basically inactive or passive investing, which is obviously really good. And I also have investments into just like go to the indices basically. Mm-hmm. And I don't really actively manage it. But if it's not properly, if people are not properly trained about how to use these robo and, you know, like passive investing, there's a big danger in there. That's distancing people from their money. So you or most of professional investors, they never going to distance from their money, because by their profession, they already understand the rule of money and how to save and how to manage your money and all that sort of stuff. But when you tell a person, a very young person, that you don't need to worry about, you don't even need to understand what's in your, where your money is going. And let's just put it this in robo advising, or let's just passively manage it. What happens is gradually is a distance between you and money. And then people start forgetting about, okay, they need to still understand what's going on into their investments. That triggers into, okay, how much I save, that triggers into how would I train or teach my kids and my younger kids in terms of learning how to manage their money. There's this ripple effect of when you distance people from their money and their investments, although it may be good for them for that period of time, but gradually in the long term, there is a adverse effect. I think most of the people ignore that. I don't think financial industry should go down the way of distancing people from their money. And that's where behavioral aspect comes in, because we should use behavioral, or at least that's our point of view, we should use behavioral finance to help people make better decisions without distancing from their money, because that's a danger, hidden danger that a lot of these passive and robo platforms ignore.
Yeah, I think one thing that I've written about in my books is that there really is no such thing as there's no black and white when it comes to investment products. Everything has advantages and disadvantages. And I tried to be very frank in my writing about the advantages and disadvantages of a number of different types of products. And I think it becomes dangerous when things get viewed as all good or all bad, right? Yeah. People begin to overlook dangers. They become estranged from their money, as you say. And so I'm glad there's people like you who are trying to make, reignite that connection between people and understanding what they hold. So speaking of education, one of the pieces of bad news that I think I have to give people very consistently in my job as a killjoy educator is that I have to, you know, bring to light the research around how weak a predictor of behavior education is. You know, knowing the right thing to do and doing the right thing don't have a whole lot in common. Like, I still really want to drink that milkshake, even though I know just what it's going to do to me. So you and I are in agreement about sort of embedding a behavioral finance process into the technology, baking it in, giving this just-in-time advice. Mm-hmm. Talk about the power of an embedded approach to behavioral finance, a baked-in, just-in-time approach versus the current financial education model of, hey, learn something and then go do it. Why is this embedded approach more powerful in your estimation?
Yeah, I mean, I think you just nail it. It's that analogy of like knowing what to do and not implementing it because of that immediate satisfaction, right? You will have that, or I will certainly have that milkshake one way or another because there is that immediate satisfaction. And then I could have been on a diet and my doctor could have said all these things and I may know like I have a high, you know, blood sugar and thing. Actually, I don't have high blood sugar, but like I may have all these like diseases, or like stuff that I know I should not eat this, but I will do it because of that immediate satisfaction. But imagine if at that moment you would had an opportunity that somebody would surface the information to you and say, listen, what this eating this thing's gonna tell you, this is gonna do to you. It's gonna delay your plan for getting healthy, but this amount of time, or the immediate impact. If you make it more tangible by using the power of technology, there's a lot of power in that nudge, as we call it, right? At that moment of decision making. And then the other part of it is that you could personalize that nudge to people, because you may be very logical. You are a very logical person. So if I give you the information at the right time, you may change your behavior and not have milkshake, or at least order half of that milkshake as opposed to like eat half of it and then give, you know, throw half of it away just to kind of scratch that itch, but not eat all of it. And then another person may need to talk to a doctor at that point. Right. So there's this the what you embed in the past matters as much as understanding when to intervene. And that's where technology does a fantastic job, because we using the technology, you can figure out, you can look at what kind of nudges changes people's behavior. Daniel may just need a bit of information and he will do just fine. Hoda may need to talk to an expert at that moment. Another person may need multiple nudges and notifications at the time in order to change their course of action. And then some people don't even do it, right? Like, and then you have to figure out how to correct that person's course of action. So there's these two aspects. There is the ability of using technology to intervene at the right time and recognizing when is that right time. And then the second part is the ability to personalize what you tell that person at that point. How would you personalize that message at that point, and through what channel that actually results in the change of course of action? And it's just because people respond, like some people learn visually, some people learn through audio, some people learn by reading and repeating. So you can't ignore those two aspects, delivery of the method of delivery and the moment of delivery. They both have to be personalized, and technology is the only thing, like a scalable technology is the only thing that actually deliver both.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, we'll just keep using the milkshake, right? I mean, the traditional educational model says you're going to have a high school class that tells you that ice cream's fattening and hope that 20 years later, you're going to choose not to drink that milkshake because of some class you had in high school. Versus the technological process says that as I'm walking up to the cash register to buy that ice cream, I get a message that says, hey, Daniel, this is what it's going to do to the number on your scale. This is what it's going to do to your physical goals. This is what it's going to do to your mile time. All of this, it's personalized, it's timely, it's easy, it's immediate, it's salient. Technology has the power to do what we have never done before with behavioral finance. And I'll be the first to admit, you know, I write all these books, I question how much good they do, right? It's really taking the knowledge from these books and baking it into an easy, timely, personalized approach that I think is going to be the future.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. Obviously, I mean, your books inspire people like me, and millions of other people who read your books, because then they will think about how to implement these frameworks. So never stop writing books, because I have to say I read a few of your books, and every time I read something, I take a lot of notes, and then it influences how we build the company. So I wanted to say that don't stop writing books. It inspires a lot of other people to create things based on that framework. Anyways, one of the reasons we started a Stock Card and we thought about that this is even possible is because people like you, or like all the other behavioral finance experts or behavioral decision-making experts, gave us the framework to build the technology on top of it. And that's sort of like what I always talk about, like a moment, the stars are being aligned at this moment by behavioral finance gave a framework to create behaviorally driven products. And AI technology and machine learning gives us the tool to be able to deliver that. And that's where the stars are aligned together. Without the framework of behavioral finance or behavioral decision making, it's very difficult. And as you know, we talked about it, there is hundreds at least of behavioral mistakes that you could talk about. And then if you don't have the framework that summarizes it and simplify it into something that is actionable, it's very difficult to build a product on top of it, right? So the frameworks of behavioral finance and what people like you are doing, it's paramount to be able to build the technology on top of it.
Well, I'm very flattered, but I will tell you, if millions of people had read my book, we wouldn't be having this conversation. I'd be on the beach spending my royalty money. But no, I do appreciate it. So we'll get a little personal now as we wrap up. Hoda, you recently became an American citizen. So congratulations, first and foremost. So what is your favorite part about your new country? And then where can we improve? Give us a little gentle feedback as well.
No, that's a tough question. I think one of the areas that I'm fascinated by when it comes to the United States is the presence of checks and balances. And I think it's very unique to the United States. No, a lot of people can get very powerful in the United States, but nobody can be the absolute power. And that's, I think, where things go wrong, when you have absolute power and then when you believe, and in any context, right? You could be absolute power in as a CEO, absolute power as head of a state, absolute power as president, or, you know, in any aspects of life. The United States has done this fascinating job of creating new checks and balances. Nobody will, there is always somebody that will check your work. And we'll finally, and, you know, like in world of finance, SEC, like a lot of people like bash SEC. I'm in love with what SEC does, because they bring in this rules and boundaries around finance and world of investing that it may not be immediate. It may not catch everything immediate, but everybody knows there's somebody is watching. And then at some point they're going to catch up with that. So I really think one of the reasons the United States is very successful is this presence of this checks and balances system. And I'm Persian, Canadian, and now American. And I've lived in a couple of countries, and I think it's very unique to the United States. That's one of the reasons that the United States is successful. So that's my appreciation for the country. What can the United States do better? I think... It's not only for the United States, I think every country or every person that belongs to any community needs to understand that they're not that unique, and they can have a lot of unique features. But if you travel around the world, you're going to see a lot of other people also all like you, and a lot of other people also have a lot of good qualities to them, and a lot of other systems out there that have good quality and good features to them. I think it's a fascinating country. It could be a little more like have a little bit more sympathy for the rest of the world and see like a lot of other people are also going through similar things and have similar thoughts and similar good things and similar bad things. So that's a little bit of a philosophical thing, but I think that could help the United States.
So if the USA took a used stock card, it might be diagnosed as overconfident. Is this what you're saying gently?
Thank you so much for concluding that. I did not want to say that, but it's a good thing, you know, it's a good thing. It helps growth, but yeah, it would be good to be self-aware.
Yeah, perfect. So in closing, the last part of our podcast is always the free association part. So this is something psychologists do, throw out a word and you just give us the first thing that comes to your mind. Okay, so here we go. Your personal biggest behavioral bias.
Oh, we talked about this, is narrative. I love stories. That's why I have so many crushes, product crushes, CEO crushes, book crushes. Like at each moment of time, I'm in love with something or a few things. And it's just because I love that story. It's very difficult for me to overcome the good stories. And then I need to consciously, you know, sit down. I'm like, okay, what? Let's go back through the list of bad things about this thing that you really like.
Yeah. One or two of your favorite behavioral finance books that were not written by me. You've already given me a nice nod. What are some of your favorite behavioral finance books?
Oh, so it's sort of going with the theme of stories. I think The Undoing Project, which is the story of how Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman started their collaborations. I love, 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 love that book. And the reason is just, is not only is it a technical book in terms of like talks about all these aspects of like behavioral fallacies and issues and cognitive biases, but there's like a beautiful friendship story. Basically as the foundation of the book. I loved it so much that I convinced my husband to listen to it because he's into sci-fi and fantasy and things like that. He rarely reads these kind of books. I talked about it so much. And like, it was just so such a big part of our life that I think at some point he's like, just let me read this book and then be done with it because you can't stop talking about it.
So The Undoing Project by Michael Lewis. Very good book. Very, very good book. Okay, final question. Where do you see Stock Card 5 years from now?
Oh, I think we're going to change how do-it-yourself investors are being perceived. Today, do-it-yourself investors are seen as the weakest link in the asset management world. And I think the perception is going to change and we will have do-it-yourself investors that are our best asset managers in the world. And I think it's finally our moment to shine. Our do-it-yourself investors, we're going to get there.
That is an audacious and a worthy goal. I love it. So if people have enjoyed this conversation and they want to get to know you better, where can they find you online? Where can they learn more about your business?
Yeah, obviously stockcard.io is our website. I write extensively on our blog, blog.stockcard.io. And then also we have a Facebook community, the Intelligent Investors Facebook community. There's about 5,000 people in that community. And I talk about the stocks and markets and everything all day long with our fellow Facebook group members.
Very cool. Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us and thanks for your insights today.
Thank you very much for having me. It was excellent.
Thanks for tuning in to Standard Deviations. If you can't wait till next week for more behavioral finance insights, visit www.orion.com. All opinions expressed by Dr. Daniel Crosby and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of or endorsement by Orion and its affiliates, subsidiaries, and employees. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for legal, tax, and investment decisions. The opinions are based upon information the participants consider reliable.